thank you very much. I want to tell you about my medallions I'm wearing tonight before I begin my talk. This silver medallion was given to me by my sponsor, Willie B. of Spring, Texas. Some of you might know her. And Willie's been my sponsor, and she gave me this medallion on my 25th AA birthday last year. And Willie's been my sponsor the last 8 or 9 years, because my original sponsors, one of them died and one of them moved out of the state. And even though I had been sober 18 years, I still felt like I needed a backup sponsor. So I chose Willie, and it was one of the best choices I have ever made. Now, this medallion, there's a little story attached to this. Have any of y'all ever seen the movie or the musical, The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas? Okay. Well, there was a famous whorehouse in Texas called the Chicken Ranch at LaGrange, Texas. And it had been in business for over 100 years. And it was located between the University of Texas and Texas A&M, and it did a thriving business. And a TV personality in Houston got crosswise with the sheriff down there and through bad publicity had it closed down. And there was a lot of moaning and groaning when the Chicken Ranch got closed down, I might add. Well, I had had my V's a couple of months and worn them several times, and I looked down one day and I saw a chicken and a rooster engraved on my medallion, and I thought, I wonder what that says. And when I read it, I nearly fainted, because on one side it says the Chicken Ranch, LaGrange, Texas, and on the other side it says, good for all night. Oh, I've had more fun with this medallion. My name is Mary, and I am an alcoholic. And I have been sober since April the 21st of 1964, one day at a time. Thank you. And this miracle of sobriety, this amazing grace, is because of a divine and loving providence, my two beloved sponsors, Gloria and Lee H., and because of people exactly like you. I am, I've lost my place. Don't ask me what happened. I guess I have been so nervous trying to get up here. And y'all can't help me because you've never heard me before. Oh, dear. Well, anyway, I grew up in a small West Texas town called Breckenridge, and it's deep in the heart of Texas. And my mother and father were the church leaders they were the social leaders of the church group in this small town, and they entertained a lot. But being good Baptists, they didn't drink alcohol and they didn't serve alcohol, but they worked for it and they weren't against it. And my little friends that belonged to the country club set, their parents drank alcohol and served alcohol, and it was just all right. And I grew up in my formative years thinking alcohol was a beverage. And the Lord knows it ain't no soda pop. Oh, it is a mood altering chemical formula, and it was so toxic to me it almost cost me my life. Now, I am married, and for some reason lately I have been thinking a lot about marriage and alcoholics. There's one man in Houston 6 years ago in AA had been married 11 times. And I sponsor a woman that has been married 8 times. And I have a friend, Jack S. of Louisville, Kentucky, that has a friend that says he has jars of peanut butter that lasted longer than some of his marriages. Well, I just want to tell y'all, I didn't get to have all this fun. Because I have been married to the same husband all of my life, one day at a time. I'm the mother of 2 grown sons, and I thank God every day they're grown and raised. You taught me in this program that I could not live my son's lives, and as a result of this, I let go of these boys, and they live their lives and tend to their business, and I live my life and tend to mine, and we have a pretty good relationship. Now, I am a grandmother, but I ain't the babysitting kind of grandmother. Because the idea of baking cookies and entertaining grandchildren is just not the way I want to spend my day. And I belong to an old and honorable profession. I am a housewife. Now, I am not a member of the oldest profession. and it's a damn good thing. Considering my mean-spirited personality and how ugly I look, I would have starved to death. I took my first drink when I was a senior in high school, and it ended in complete disaster. I got drunk, I got sick, I threw up on everybody just like a flamethrower. And you know, the next day when I woke up with my first hangover, I suffered a lingering death for 2 days just getting over that hangover. But this was such a bad trip for me that I didn't drink anything for the next 8 or 10 years. And in that length of time, I had married, and I was the mother of these small sons, and we were buying a new used home and a new used car all on one salary, and there wasn't enough money left over for me. Anyway, there wasn't enough money left over from our salary for me to have help with my housework. And I hated housework, and I had an awful lot of housework to do. And Irma Bombeck says, housework, if it's done right, can kill you. But I felt that housework like this little hippie bride. She told her best friend, she said, oh, housework is such a drag. She said, you wash the dishes and make up the beds, and 3 weeks later, you have to do it all over again. And one afternoon, I was trying to wade through a big ironing. And back in those days, you had to iron everything but the socks and the underwear. And a friend came by and suggested a cold beer. And it was a hot, humid Houston afternoon. And I thought, well, it's just a beverage. And when I drank those 2 beers that afternoon, alcohol did something for me. First, it made me feel like $1 million. And second, it gave me energy. And on those 2 beers, I got through that ironing, humming all the way, and had dinner on the table when my husband came in. I had all this energy, and I thought, oh, boy, I have found the answer. And, oh, boy, had I found an answer. It wasn't long that I was drinking 2 to 4 beers a day to get through my housework. Then I'd go up to 4 to 6 beers a day. 6 to 8, I had the cleanest house in Houston. I was such a good housekeeper, I even put newspapers under the cuckoo clock. When I got up to 8 to 10 beers, I thought, I better switch to bourbon. And within 2 years after drinking that beer that afternoon, I was in serious trouble with my alcoholism, only I didn't know that's what it was. And this is when I started experiencing a personality change. Did any of you ever have a personality change when you drank? Well, my personality change became so dangerous and so bizarre that my family had to take the firing pins out of all the guns in the house. I ain't called shotgun for nothing. Because when they would accuse me, or they would argue with me, or they would criticize me, in my drunken rage, I would grab the gun and I would try to shoot them. And I am described perfectly in the big book on page 21 in 3 sentences where it says, the alcoholic does the absurd, incredible, and tragic things while drinking. He is a regular Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He is seldom mildly intoxicated. He is always more or less insanely drunk. And that fits me to a T. And my family got to where they could anticipate my rages and they would hide the guns from me, but I could find them. And then they got to where they would take all the ammunition and lock it up in a pump house under a great big lock. Well, they had me foiled for a while. But one morning I had to get up and get my husband off to work and these 2 boys off to school. I think one of them was in kindergarten. And I had committed the error of terror, terrible thing the night before. I hadn't left anything to wake up on in the morning. So I would use, don't ever tell me an alcoholic doesn't have willpower, because I used iron willpower and waited till 9 o'clock and so I could go to the liquor store. And I was in the living room watching the clock because it took 15 minutes to get to the liquor store. And I was remembering how mean they had been to me the night before. all three of them had jumped on me and had tongues of vipers. And then they wouldn't let me shoot them. Now, many a morning I had gotten to the liquor store before it opened, and I would be standing out there with those winos and those weirdos, and this was humiliating to me. And I know tonight that I was exactly like those winos. It was just a matter of degree, and I also know tonight my behavior was pretty weird, too. But I was going to wait till 9 o'clock, and then I could go in that liquor store like a lady and buy my 2 or 3 half pints of Old Crow. And while I was watching the clock, I thought, well, I know just what I'll do. I'll stop back by the hardware store, and I'll buy my own ammunition. Brilliant thought, which I did. And I didn't buy ordinary shells. I bought hollow points. Now, this is ammunition that is not designed to wound. It is designed to devastate. And this loving wife and mother came home from the liquor store and the hardware store with several boxes of devastating ammunition. Well, I knew what my family would do when they realized what I had done, so I started hiding these shells all over the house, upstairs and downstairs and under the carpet and in the drapes, and 10 or 15 little bitty shells, 22 shells. And I have often wondered what those people thought that we sold that house to. And you know, after I had outsmarted my husband, my alcoholic husband, and these two small sons, I felt real smug. And nothing happened, uneventful happened, for several months. I didn't always lose control and get insane when I drank. Sometimes I drank and loved everybody. Sometimes I drank and was industrious. And sometimes I drank and passed out. And sometimes I drank and mumbled all through the day. But I never knew what was going to happen to me when I drank. But one afternoon, my husband and these two boys were out in the backyard, and they were pitching horseshoes, and they were having such a good time. And I was in the house. My husband is a beer alcoholic, and the ice box was full of beer. And I was sipping on his beer, and then I would go in my dresser drawer where I had 3 or 4 pints, half pints of Old Crow, and I'd take a slug of Old Crow and go back in there and chase it with his beer. And I want to tell you here tonight that I drank so much Old Crow before I got to this program, that's exactly what I look like 26 and a half years ago. I'm just glad I didn't drink Old Granddad. Or Wild Turkey. My husband came in to get a beer, and he looked at me and he says, "Mary, how in the hell can you be so drunk on 2 beers?" I looked up at him so innocent-like. I said, "I don't know. It must be my metabolism." I didn't know what that meant, but it sounded good. And they were having such a good time out there, and I was getting on one of these mean drunks, and I started resenting them having a good time, and that's when I remembered my little catch of shells, and I thought, I'm going to shake. I got this 22 one night in a poker game when I was drunk. And I loaded it, and I wasn't going to shoot them this time. I was just going out and shake them up a little bit. So I went out on the back porch, and I fired into the ground 2 or 3 times. Beep, beep. And, oh, you never saw a covey of quail staring the way my life was there. They, ooh. You know, one went east, one went west, and one went over the cuckoo's nest. And they were cats, and one ran behind the boat shed, and one ran behind this great big oak tree, and one ran behind the side of the house, and they were catcalling back and forth. What in the world had happened? I had double-crossed them again. And they came to 2 conclusions. The first conclusion, that gun was loaded. And the second conclusion was, so was I. So it was after this that they started taking the firing pins out of all the guns in the house. You know, one of the most insidious phases of this disease of alcoholism is we turn against those that we love and need the most. And in my, it was after this, when I felt threatened, I would revert to the butcher knives and the meat cleavers and the ice picks. And many a morning I have gotten up to fix breakfast for my family, and I'd open the knife drawer, and it would be completely empty. There wouldn't be anything in that drawer with a point or an edge on it. And my heart would just fall to the floor. And I would make this long, slow walk down to my son's bedroom, never knowing what I was going to find. But I checked them out, and they had their ears and their noses, and they were breathing, and oh, I would be so vastly relieved. But when I had found these butcher knives and this great big meat cleaver up under their pillows, I would know I had just been dreadful the night before. And I'd reach up under their pillow to get a butcher knife to go in the kitchen so I could finish breakfast. And I would walk back to my kitchen with the sickest heart and the heaviest soul that you have ever seen. And I'd put these knives in the sink so I could, finish breakfast. And I had a window over my kitchen sink, and it faced out toward the east. And always about this time, the sun was rising. And I would look out through the trees to the sunrise, and I'd think, now, if there is a God, he has to be in the sunrise. And I would say, my God, I have done it again. What is the matter with me? Because I didn't know I had a disease called alcoholism that was causing this insane behavior. And the remorse and the guilt that I felt brought on the suicide attempts. I tried to commit suicide so many times around that, it just got to be old hat around our house. One evening, my husband came in from work, and he looked up at the gun rack, and he says, Mary, where's my shotgun? I said, it's upstairs. And he said, well, what is it doing upstairs? And I said, well, I was planning to kill myself. And he undid his tie and walked past me, and he said, what, again? And once I jumped out of a car, it was going about 80 miles an hour. And where I jumped, I just rolled end over end, and there were great big old jagged pieces of concrete, big old glass thing. Anything in that ditch could have killed me. And I spent 8 days in the hospital over this little attempt because I almost skinned myself alive. I took the skin off of every part of my body. And every morning that old doctor, he was a mean so-and-so. He would come in there with a big old pair of tweezers, and he would pull off all the dead skin so new skin could form. And every day for 8 days I'd scream in pain, and he would say, well, you shouldn't have jumped. And every day for 8 days I'd say, well, hell, I know that now. But I knew the law of averages was going to catch up with me, and I did not want to die. I just didn't want to live this sick way I was living. And this is when I made a decision that I would go to the doctor and get myself checked over and find out what was wrong with me. And this was the beginning of my prescription phase of my alcoholism. And before it was over, I took Energizer, Stabilizer, Tranquilizer, Barbiturates, and a lot of narcotics. I also drank a lot of Paragoric. But I never smoked pot. And I'm going to tell you, it wasn't odd at all for the druggist to call me and say, Mrs. Moncrest, there is a new prescription on the market. I thought perhaps it might help you. I'd say, well, Mr. Blank, you just send it out. But I never smoked pot, I never snorted cocaine, and I never used heroin for three reasons only. That's the medical profession, the pharmaceutical company, and the liquor industry. With these three organizations going for me, I didn't need anything else to get me through the day. And while this doctor was interviewing me, I told him, I said, now, I drink nearly every day, and nearly every day I get drunk. I might even be an alcoholic. And he looked across the desk at me and smiled, and he said, nonsense. A nice little woman like you couldn't be an alcoholic. And I agreed with him 100%. But he ran a whole battery of tests on me, including a liver function test, a spinal tap, the whole smear, and he couldn't find anything wrong with me. I was in perfect health, and I was dying. But he was alarmed about my suicide attempts, which he attributed to depression. Now, I don't know about you, but when I'd wake up in the morning with a hangover, I was depressed. And he started me on a weekly series of vitamin and hormone shots, and he started me on the amphetamine drug, which is the pep pill. And in my case, it was the dexedrine sansur, I think 15 milligrams. And this medication is used for depression, and it's also used in weight control. because what it does, it jazzes up your thyroid and gives you a lot of energy. It depresses the appetite centers in your brain, and you're not hungry. So you gin around a lot and don't eat, ergo you lose weight. But if you abuse these amphetamines the way I did, you'll also lose some of your marbles. And I came home from the doctor's office with a great big bottle of reducing medicine and weighed 90 pounds dripping wet. But within 30 minutes after I took that first pep pill, my God, I thought I had been reborn. Oh, my depression left me, and I was energetic, and I was happy, and I thought, oh boy, I have found the answer again, once again. And when my husband came in from work that evening, the boys met him at the back door, and they said, oh, Daddy, guess what? Mother feels good. So once again, I thought I had found the answer. But this wonderful medication had a bad drawback to it. I was so exhilarated and happy, I couldn't sleep. And after not sleeping good for two or three nights, just fitfully, I called the doctor to tell him about this, and he was so happy that my depression left me, and he sure did want me to sleep. So he sent me my first prescription for the sleeping tablets. So I'd get up in the morning, I'd take my pep pill, and I'd take the sleeping tablets at night. Now the icebox is full of beer, and I reach in there and start drinking again, and I start losing control, and I call the doctor to tell him about this. And he's of the opinion that the speed run of the amphetamine needs to be slowed down. And there is a brand new drug on the market called a tranquilizer. And he sent me a prescription and it had the magic words on the bottle, take as needed. So I was getting up in the morning, taking my pep pill, taking the tranquilizer through the day and the sleeping tablet at night. It went along till I was doubling up and tripping up on all of these. And the icebox is still full of beer, and I'm still alcoholic. And as an alcoholic, it is as normal for me to drink as it is for me to breathe. And I reach in there, and I start drinking again. Now, I've been going every week to get my vitamin hormone shots, and when I started mixing alcohol with all that medication, it was taking a dreadful toll of me. My naturally curly hair became limp and stringy. I've always been a little cross-eyed. Back in those days, I went around with one eye closed a lot of the time. I had a green cast to my complexion with undertones of yellow. I had lost 5 pounds on my reducing medicine. Now, if this isn't bad enough, skinny, cross-eyed, and green. I was growing fine hair all over my face and chin and the mustache. And listen, to add insult to injury, this was long before the event of my gray hair, and it was coal black. I don't know how long I had looked like this, but my family wouldn't have said a word to me if I'd been growing horns and a tail. Because they wouldn't want to do anything to upset mother. And like I said, I don't know how long I'd looked this way, but one day I had to go someplace and I had to powder my face. And this is when I made an amazing discovery. If you have a beard, you can't powder your face. That powder was going everywhere but where I wanted it to. And I looked through that blur and saw myself, and I nearly fainted. And I thought, my God, surely I'm not supposed to be growing a black mustache. And I don't know where I was going that day, but I took myself to the doctor's office just as quick as I could get there. And back in those days, you didn't have to have an appointment. You just went to the doctor's office. And while I was in his office waiting for him to come in to see this apparition that I had become, I was just petrified with fear. And I thought, my God, what if I have to start shaving every day? And you know, he came in, took one look at my face and turned it from side to side, and he said, honey, I'm not worried about that on your face. It's caused from the hormone shots. He said, I want to know if you're growing any hair on your chest. This is the most insulting thing anybody ever asked me in my whole life. I started unbuttoning my blouse, and when I got to this button, the full import of what he said to me, hit me, and I was blazing mad. And I looked up at him and I said, I don't know, you son of a bitch, but I better not be. You never saw a monkey looking for fleas when I was trying to. But I was spared that indignity. But you can bet all your blue chip stocks and your gold edge bonds I quit taking those hormone shots right then. And on the way home, that was a sobering experience, by the way. It took about 6 weeks for my to get back to normal. But on the way home, I told myself, I made a firm vow that I was never going to drink again. That was it. And within 30 minutes, I had a drink in my hand and I didn't know what I was going to do. And it was along about this time that they were writing a lot of articles in the newspapers and the magazines about alcoholism and about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I read every one of these things avidly. Boy, I was really interested in this alcoholism. And I made a decision that I was going to the library and research alcoholism. In case I ever got it, I would know what it was. And at the library, they had two books on alcoholism. One was a book entitled Drinking is Not the Problem, and the other was the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know which book I read first. And in this book, this man had been married to a nagging woman for about 11 years, and he drank every day, got drunk, and as soon as he quit her, he hadn't had a drink in 2 years when he wrote this book. Now, that impressed me. I thought, well, of course. It's all the Nar's fault. I'll just quit him and I'll get okay. Right along behind that thought came another thought. Oh, Lord, if I quit Lenar, I'll have to go to work. And I had sense enough to know I was totally unemployable. But anyway, in reading the big book, they told me that alcoholism was a three-way illness. It was emotional, it was mental, it was physical, and it was spiritual. And I thought, well, that's what my problem is. I haven't been to church in years. I was raised in the church just like I go to AA now, but my church was my whole life when I was growing up. And I thought, I'll be all right. And I went back to my church, and I wasn't all right. I kept drinking. And I went to other denominations, and I kept drinking. And I got special counseling downtown. The big churches had counselors down there, but that's kind of like, you know, they didn't know anything about alcoholism, and I didn't either, and they were on the way on the sun. They could help me. But I do know that I was a dyed-in-the-wool Baptist getting counseling from a Methodist minister. You know, that's almost blasphemy. But some of these, after we'd talk a while, one of the ministers, we'd hold hands, and he'd say a prayer over me, you know, and I'd come leave there, and I'd just be, that's the only time in my drinking I felt a little bit good. And I'd just be so happy on the way home, and I'd pass the liquor store, and I'd drive in there, and I'd say, there I was all flamed again, and I didn't know what I was going to do. And the only weekend that my husband was out of town, it was a cold February, rainy, damp, and the boys and I had an agreement. They were in the front of the house entertaining themselves, and I was in the back drinking and passing out and drinking and passing out. And all day long this had been going on, and I came to about 6 o'clock, and my conscience was just killing me. I had neglected the boys again. So I thought, well, I'll make it up to them. I'll go in the kitchen. I'll fix them something real good to eat. And I went in the kitchen, and I got an egg out of the icebox, and I dropped it on the floor. And every time I tell this story, I still feel that egg's on between my toes, because, of course, I ain't any shoes on. And I reached in the icebox and got another egg, and I dropped it all over the floor. And I looked down at those two eggs spattered all over the kitchen floor, and I said, Lord, I'm too drunk to cook. I'll take the boys to the drive-in. I wasn't too drunk to drive. And on the way back from the drive-in, I missed my own driveway, and I got stuck in the ditch in front of my house, and I couldn't get out. And the boys ran next door when I started raving like an idiot, and they ran next door. And I lived on a dead-end street, and there were four other families on this street, and our children played together. And none of these women could drive, and I took the kids to school every day and picked them up every day, drunk or sober. And I liked these women pretty good when I was sober, which wasn't often. But when I was drunk, I just despised them. And you know whose fault it was my car was stuck out there in that ditch. It was all their fault. And I got out of my car in a loud screaming voice, and I cursed these women. I called them everything in the books that I could think to call somebody. And when I was drunk and in a rage, I had the vocabulary of a mule skinner. And then came the dawn. Oh, the house was wide open. It had rained in. It was cold. I went to the back door to close it, and I saw the eggs, and I remembered the eggs. When I went to the front door to close it and saw my car, I sure did remember what I had done. And I knew what I had to do. I had to go around and apologize to these. The next day, they were ladies. Isn't that amazing? I had to go around the next day and apologize to these ladies. And I told each one of them that I had been drunk the night before. I was ashamed of myself, and I asked them to forgive me. And I came back home, and this was the first time in a long time, 3, 4, 5 years, that my drinking had gone outside the confines of my home in my backyard. In my husband's job, we used to have to go out a lot. Of course, there was always drinking. And, you know, I would lose control lots of times. Invariably, we'd go out, and I would start a scene with somebody. And it wouldn't be some little 5'8" fella like my husband. It would be some 6'5" fella. And Lenore would have to come and, you know, protect my dignity and take me home. And the last time that happened, he brought me home and sat me down on the bed, and he said, "Now, Mary, I will never take you out in public again because you are going to get me killed." And he was right. And, you know, I was sober 2 or 3 years before he trusted me enough to take me out in public. But several of the doctors that I had gone to had said perhaps a psychiatrist might help me. But up until this little incident happened, I wasn't willing to go to a psychiatrist. But Monday morning, I called the psychiatrist, and the next Tuesday morning, I was in his office bright and early. And through the night, I had thought, well, I'll lie to him. I won't help. I've got to have something done for me. But I decided not to do that. But when I got to this psychiatrist, I told him everything I could think of to tell him about me. I told him about my sexual fantasies. I told him about my erotic dreams. I did not leave a stone unturned because I wanted help. And he made a decision to put me in Herman Hospital in February of 1949. This was before half of you in this room were even born, to take a series of insulin shock treatments. He wanted me to take 60, but we couldn't afford but 30. We couldn't really afford those, but we borrowed some money from my mother. We never did pay her back, by the way. And I was doing pretty good in the hospital. I had my sleeping tablets at night, and I had this shock treatment every morning, and I hated these shock treatments. They are brutal. But if this was the price I had to pay to get well, I was willing to pay any price. And the psychiatrist came in every morning and every evening and talked to me, and we just got to be real good buddies. And I had been in there about 3 weeks, and he came in my room one morning, and he said, "Mary, you don't have a thing in this world to worry about. You are not an alcoholic." And I tell you, I wasn't happy with this diagnosis, but it was the only one I had. But I will say this, because of this diagnosis or misdiagnosis, I drank for another 15 sick, humiliating, degrading years. 15 long years. But you know, he didn't know anything about alcoholism. However, he and his partner were supposed to be the leading authorities on alcoholism in the city of Houston at that time. But see, that's been a long time ago. And I gained 20 pounds in that 30 days, and I got back home, and I lost every bit of it in 6 weeks, and I was off and running again, and I didn't know what I was going to do. But I sought other psychiatrists. I went to a chiropractor, a psychologist, a faith healer, a hypnotist. I would have embraced any creed, any cult who had gotten well because I was getting so desperate. And one of the psychologists working with my medical doctor put me on the drug antabuse. And this is medication that if it's in your bloodstream and you drink alcohol, it could make you violently ill and it could cause your death. And you had to be sober 3 days, free of alcohol 3 days before you could take that first antabuse tablet back there. Then we like to never gotten that first antabuse tablet back. The doctor would call and he'd say, well, are you drinking today? And I'd say, I just had one beer. And he said, oh, you've blown it again. But anyway, so the last 6 weeks of my drinking, I stayed sober 2 days to 6 weeks on antabuse. And I'd get off of antabuse and I would drink 2 days to 6 weeks. And it wasn't a very good way to live. But in 1962, I had to go to Wichita Falls to a wedding. In Wichita Falls, Texas, by the way, to a wedding. And at the reception after this wedding, I was visiting with an aunt from another city, and I turned to walk away from Aunt City for some reason, and she called out to me. She said, oh, Mary, said, by the way, your cousin Gloria is moving to Houston. Said she is in AA now, and she's just doing beautifully. But when Aunt City called these words out to me, a hush fell over that room. Everything got so quiet you could have heard a pin drop. And in that moment of quiet, something way deep inside of me said, I am going to be saved. The knowledge was given to me that somehow between Gloria and AA, I was going to be made whole again. Now, Gloria was a complete stranger to me. I just knew I had a cousin named Gloria that lived in Oklahoma. And you'd think after I'd been trying, going up all these blind alleys, I'd get in touch with Gloria and get sober and everything just be wonderful. But it didn't work out that way. I had some more drinking to do. And after about 3 months, I did finally get in touch with Gloria. And she hadn't talked to me over 2 minutes till she said, why, Mary, you are an alcoholic. And you know what? That's the first correct diagnosis I had had in about 15 or 16 years. And I knew she was right. And I remember the weight lifted from my shoulders that I was an alcoholic. It explained so much to me, but I still wasn't ready to quit drinking. And Gloria says, if I hadn't been alcoholic, she never would have fooled with me because she didn't like kin folks. But Gloria talked to me every day for 13 months before I went to my first AA meeting. And I'd say, well, Gloria, I'm not drinking today. I'm taking antabuse. And she'd say, well, honey, ordinary social drinkers don't have to take antabuse to not drink. And she would tell me I had a disease. It was progressive, it was incurable, and it terminates fatally. She would just scare the liver out of me. And this went on for 13 months. And she said, as an alcoholic, I have three choices. I can be locked up, covered up in a cemetery, or sobered up. Lordy me, that was a terrible choice to have to make. But in 1963, our youngest son went away to school. And it was the oldest one had gone off 4 years previously. And it was the only time in all of my drinking that I didn't have somebody coming in to monitor me. And this is when I nearly drank myself to death. I drank solid for 3 weeks. And this is when I tried to commit suicide in a blackout. Now, believe me, this scared the hell out of me. I took the attitude, if I was going to commit suicide, I wanted to know about it. I didn't want to just wake up the next morning dead. And this is when I got on the phone and I called Gloria and I said, Gloria, I need help. And she said, yes, honey, I know you do. We have been fooling around about this long enough. And that was the night that Gloria and Lee came out to make a 12-step call on me and my husband. And while I was waiting for them to come, I had on the same pajamas and housecoat that I'd had on for 3 or 4 days. I had a bad habit on some of my drunks that I wouldn't take a bath or comb my hair, brush my teeth, because I didn't want to lose my buzz. And it just wasn't important to me. That's the reason I left the foo-foo up since I'm sober in AA. And my husband is such a fastidious alcoholic, he even takes showers during blackouts. To me, that's revolting. But anyway, I'd been 3 or 4 days, and I hadn't had a bath, and it was bothering him no end. And we were both about half drunk, and he made a fatal mistake. He decided he was going to give me a bath. When he took me in the bathroom and locked the door, I didn't know he was going to give me a bath. when he started undressing me, I sure didn't know he was going to give me a bath. When he got me completely undressed, he turned on the shower and shoved me in there. Oh, I came out of there like a mad wet hen. Oh, and it was push and shove for a while, and finally he got in the shower with me, clothes and all, and he was behind me holding me like this, and he was trying to soak me. And he said, "I'm going to give you a bath, damn you." And I said, "No, you ain't, damn you." And I started kicking, and I kicked at all three sides of that shower stone. It was completely demolished. And I'll tell you one thing, that was the last time he ever tried to give me a shower. But anyway, several weeks later, the boys were out on the back porch, and they were bored to death. All the kids in the neighborhood had something to do with them. And oh, they were grumbling. One of them said, "Oh, I wish something interesting would happen around here." The other one brightened up and said, "Say, maybe Daddy would give Mama another bath." But when I opened the door for Gloria and Lee that night, they were the most beautiful sight I have ever seen in my life. First of all, they were clean. They were well-groomed, they were happy, they were smiling, and they were sober. And whatever it was they had, I wanted. And they came in, and we were all visiting, and Lee caught my attention, and he says, "Mary, if you could be given one wish tonight above all others, what would you ask for?" And without a moment's hesitation, I said, "I want peace of mind." He said, "You want serenity?" And I said, "You bet." And on the bottom of page 83 is the beginning of the promises, and it tells us of one of them, "We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace." And this has been given to me in AA, and because of AA only, that I have a lot of serenity in my life. And I started into AA, but I didn't follow directions. They told me to pray on my knees and to read and to go to meetings, and I didn't do it. And also, I had a few pills that I was sneaking in every once in a while. You know, I couldn't sleep or something. And I took the attitude that my doctor gave me these pills. And so I've been sober 90 days and I got drunk. On December the 23rd, I was supposed to go into my club and got my 90-day chip. And it was the first Christmas my little grandson had come to spend Christmas with grandmother, and grandmother got drunk. Anyway, I started back in AA again. I got through that drunk and started back in AA again. And this time I stayed sober 108 days. And I tell you, after this last drunk, I might have another drunk in me, but I don't have another sober enough in me. I would die trying to sober up. So this time when I came back in AA on April the 21st, 1964, I don't ever want to forget that last day of trying to sober up. I was not going to drink that day so I could get back to Travis the next day. And all day long, I knew all I had to do was just drink two beers and this nightmare would go away. But I also knew that if I started drinking that day, I would never sober up again the longest day I lived. And Gloria kept calling me all through the day, "Hang on, honey, don't drink." And that evening when I did, by the grace of God, hang on that day. And that evening when Gloria came in from work, she didn't drive and she couldn't find anybody to come out to the house to get me. And my husband had to work that day and teach school that night. He taught blueprint reading at the apprentice school. And Gloria knew that I couldn't hold out much longer. So she got me on the phone and she says, "Mary, you have to get to an AA meeting tonight." And God, I wasn't able to get in my car and go down that freeway. She said, "I'll tell you what you're going to do." She said, "You're going in your bedroom, and you're going to get down on your knees, and you're going to ask God to give you the strength to get to an AA meeting." And she added one more important sentence. She said, "And he will give you this strength." And I went in my bedroom, and I got down on my knees, and all I said was, "Dear God, give me the strength to get to an AA meeting tonight." And I know what Scotty meant last night when he said that God put his hand on his shoulder, because God put his hand on my shoulder in this first honest prayer of my entire life. Because when I rose from my knees, I have never had a compulsion to drink. The desire to drink was taken away from me, and God started healing this shattered woman. And I start back in AA, and this time I am ready to obey. Whatever they tell me to do, I am willing to do, because I don't want any more drinking. And they told me, you know, read, pray on your knees, and go to meetings. And I had a lot of bad character defects, and the most glaring one, in my opinion, was I was not able to give love to you. You were loving me and wishing me well, and I was so dead inside I couldn't love you, and I felt so guilty about this. And they said, well, read the spiritual books, read the Greek books, pray on your knees. And somewhere I read about a man in AA that felt just like I did. He was so dead inside he couldn't give love to anyone. And he borrowed a prayer from someone in AA, and I borrowed it from him. And every night when I'd say my prayers, I'd say, dear God, give me a small love to give, a small understanding, and a small love of which I might be worthy. And I don't have to tell you that this has been answered, this prayer's been answered 1,000 times over. I didn't know who this God was that was keeping me sober 24 hours at a time. I had no concept that the God of my childhood was not the one I wanted in AA. And they said, well, read, pray. Pray on your knees. They never said pray except pray on your knees. And I came across something in my readings by an old-time philosopher named Pascal, P-A-S-C-A-L. And at the bottom of a page, limned in black, all it said was, fret not thyself. If you had not found me, you would not seek me. And this had such meaning for me, I thought, I've been trying to find a God of my understanding. And I read it the second time, fret not thyself. If you had not found me, you would not seek me. And something clicked inside of me, and I thought, you know, if this old-time philosopher is right, I have already found God, or God has found me. And this was the beginning of a slow spiritual growth. It is still continuing on today. It's real slow, but it's coming along pretty good after all these years. And I love it. This concept of living one day at a time was way over my head. I was going to be happy when school started. I was going to be happy when the car was paid for. I was always going to be happy tomorrow, you know, in the future. I didn't know how to live today. And in some of my readings, I came across something Carl Sandburg wrote. He wrote, life is like an onion. You peel it back one layer at a time, and sometimes you weep. And I could, somehow or another, I could peel, you know, do my days by peeling that onion back mentally one day at a time. And I do know one thing about my today and our today. Today is a precious gift, and all we have to do is untie the ribbons. And 28 days after I... Oh, I'll have to tell you about my mother-in-law. I'm about to leave out the plague I suffered. When I married my son, I didn't know it, but I married a mother's only son. And she was sick, and she was neurotic, and she hated me with a passion. I could not do anything right for all the years that she was alive. I couldn't do anything right. I either fried the wrong egg or I boiled the wrong egg. And I tell you, she made my life so miserable. She was a barracuda. And she made my life, I let her make my life so miserable, but I got drunk at that old woman so many times. And she was still plaguing me after I got sober. And any time I could bend somebody's ears, I'd tell them how I hated that mother-in-law of mine and how mean she was. Finally, Gloria had enough of it. She says, now, Mary, if you don't quit hating this old woman, you are going to get drunk. And I said, now, just how am I going to do that? She said, well, I'm going to tell you, but you ain't going to like it. I said, well, tell me. She said, well, you're going to pray for this old woman. And I said, the hell I will. But she added one important sentence. She said, you're not going to pray for this old woman for her sake. You're going to pray for this old woman for your sake. So here I go. I don't want to get drunk, and that's the only time she ever threatened me that I might drink. And I went in my bedroom, and I stood in the doorway, and this is one of the hardest things I have had to do in my AA life. And I have a special place by my bed where I say my prayers. And when I got ready to pray for this old woman, I got clear around the corner of the bed, around the other corner, way up there. I didn't want to contaminate my good praying place. And I got down on my knees and I reluctantly put my hands together and bowed my head and I said, "Now, dear God, you know I don't mean a word I say. But you bless Ethel." And I got through at the end of my prayers every night. I'd say, bless Ethel, you know, just tack it on there. I was following directions. And so, I don't know, 9, 10 months later, the time, I don't have no idea of the time. But I woke up one morning and something was different. It took me a little while to figure it out, but I realized that I no longer hated that old woman. And I want to tell y'all, she never changed one damn bit. But she didn't have to change. I am the one that had to change. And 28 days after I took my last drink, my husband came into AA for his sake, and he has been sober 26 years last May the 19th. And thank you. And people in the beginning, and still do once in a while, come up to me and they say, "Mary, it must just be wonderful. You..." You and Lenar are both in AA now, and you can just have your own AA meeting. I want to punch him out. We can't even agree on the preamble. But that's all right. He does his AA and I do mine, and we're both sober and we're both happy, so it's just fine. But I tell you, I know that my sobriety is solely by the grace of God, but the quality of my sobriety is up to me. And this is when I started sponsoring women in AA, and this is one of the treasures of my AA life is to sponsor new women in AA. And they are a joy to me. Now, sometimes, you know, they get a little out of hand once in a while, but I won't tell y'all something else. I had cleaned up my vocabulary when I came in AA. And since I've been sponsoring all these young women, I have a brand new vocabulary. It's just amazing. It's almost double talk, I'll tell you. But anyway, I just love my AA life. I'm so grateful to be an alcoholic, and I'm so grateful to be here tonight. And, I have to tell you about my husband's fishing. My husband is a fishing nut, absolutely a fishing addict. I didn't get to see the hills of Rome or the Eiffel Tower when he had vacation time coming. We got to go fishing. So we'd been sober 4 or 5 years, and he was on vacation, and we'd been fishing 3 days, and he had just beat the socks off me. He had just caught more fish, and it was humiliating. So that night, he was going to go fishing the fourth day. He said, "Mary, are you going fishing with me in the morning?" I said, "Heck no, boy. I'll find something better to do than go out there and get beat by you. Matter of pride, you know." So I opened the gate for him to pull the boat through. And he said, "You sure you don't want to go with me?" I said, "Yeah, wait a minute. Let me go get my fishing hat." And I went in and got this old disreputable fishing hat. I wouldn't take $100 for it. And I knelt down by my bed real tight in the praying place real fast. And I said, "Now, dear God, protect my home from tigers and let me beat Lenar catching fish." We'd been out there a couple of hours and I had him beat. And I said, "Lenar, let's go." And he said, "No, I've got to at least catch up with you." So he's kept fishing. And finally, I thought he was going to catch up with me. I said, "Lenar, let's go." And he said, "No, I can't let you beat me catching fish." And I said, "Well, you just forget about that today." He got real serious. And he said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, I asked God to let me beat you catching fish." He gave me the meanest look. He took his hat off and threw it in the boat, and he said, "Now, Mary, by God, that is dirty poo." When I was drinking, I didn't care a thing in the world about material things. China and things like that meant absolutely nothing to me. I'd order everything I could over the telephone. I have ordered pool tables, washing machines, television. Of course, I had to pay it out on time, you know, but I'd order them. And so a friend, I'd been sober, I don't know, 60, 90 days, And she called from Wichita Falls, Texas, and said she wanted to come to Houston to pick out some crystal in China. And I said, well, sure, Virginia, come on down, but I have been real sick. And it took me 2 years to recuperate just a little bit from what the damage I had done to myself with alcohol and pills. And I know when I hate to shop. Oh, my husband doesn't know what a little treasure he has in me, does he? I went in the den. I told my husband, I said, isn't that the silliest thing? Drive 500 miles to buy crystal in China. But anyway, she came and I took her to a brand new store. It was a big department store. And I said, now, Virginia, here's the crystal in China department, and you just shop all you want to. I am going in the furniture department. I'm going to sit in a chair. I'm going to watch the people. I just love to watch people. Watch the people go by. And as I turned away from Virginia, a picture way in the back of the room, about as far as that exit sign up there, caught my eye. And I was drawn to this picture just like a magnet. And the closer I got, the more beautiful it became. And it was a picture of roses. And I wanted that picture. Oh, it was the most beautiful thing I had ever seen. And I looked at the price tag, and it was $139. Lord, we couldn't stand a $139 picture at that time. But, you know, it wasn't important that I couldn't afford to buy that picture. The important thing to me was I could want something again because it had been so long since I had wanted anything. And you have bad days in AA in the early days, I'd think of that picture when I was having a bad day, and my heart would start smiling, and I'd start feeling better. But one day I had to go in a department store and buy something. As I walked in the door, there was a mannequin standing there, and it had a black and white checked taffeta raincoat on it. And I saw that raincoat, and I wanted it. And I looked at the price tag, and it was $10.95. And I thought, oh, this is wonderful. I have found something that I want and something I can afford to buy. You may not know what that means, but to me it just meant the world. And it was way, they just had one, and it way too big for me, but I bought it anyway. But it had a lining in it so I could hem it up. When I got through hemming up the sleeves and the bottom of it, I looked out the window. I wanted it to start raining right then. Do you know, I didn't think it was ever going to rain in Houston. Oh, you never saw no drought farmer searching the skies for rain the way I was looking at, hoping it was going to rain today so I could go to Travis and wear my new raincoat. But into each life a little rain must fall. One day I heard the pitter-patter of rain on the roof, and I thought, oh boy, this is going to be a good rain. So I put on my raincoat and got in the car. My garage is attached to my house, and got in my car, and I was driving to Travis Club, and I was humming and singing every step of the way. I was the happiest thing you ever saw. I'm going to get to wear my new raincoat. And it kept getting worse and worse, and when I got down to the Travis Club, I opened the door to get out, and I saw how hard it was raining. It was just a deluge of rain. And I got back in the car and closed the door, and I started laughing all to myself. I had been waiting 3 weeks to wear my new raincoat, and I didn't want to get it wet. I don't know when I started, but I am going to close this down. I want to tell you that I have a lot of nicknames in AA. My husband calls me his pistolero. I'm called Fast Draw. I'm called Hip Shot. I'm called Shotgun Mary. I'm called Pistol Pete. I just whatever comes to mind, that's what I get called, and that's just fine. I love all of them. They'd call me Shotgun the rest of the convention. I'll say ho, you know. But I want to tell you that because of the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, this pistol-packing mama has laid her pistols down, and I thank you.